custody, and the peace officer shall do so immediately. Do you not interpret that as preserving your emergency powers to pick someone up?
I'm not really concerned about emergency powers, because I think when there is an emergency, we've had extremely good cooperation with the court as it is. I'm not even sure that it would, since these are so infrequent, I'm not even sure it would be necessary often enough to have a special section of statute to tell you how to do that. What I'm concerned about is that this emergency powers procedure does set the whole mechanism in operation. And what, from an administrative standpoint, I want to do is keep the number of times that this big, complicated machine runs down to an absolute minimum. Number one, because it's going to be expensive to run, and number two, because the outcome is less certain. The outcome is quite certain if by some means that does not take you into a court of law, you are able to get the correct behavioral outcome. And I've found that by issuing an appropriately worded quarantine order that simply tells a person what he's got to do and gives him some notice about what he can do if he doesn't like that order, similar to what we do under the immunization law right now, which says quite clearly, no, your child isn't going to get into school if you don't. And if you don't like this order, look on the back and you can figure out how to appeal it. I think that is a much more satisfactory administrative approach than having to go through this rather difficult process, which, because of its costliness, would probably provide a strong incentive not to get involved with quarantine actions and might result not in the most serious cases being overlooked, because in the most serious cases, we will take whatever action is necessary and expend as much of the county's budget as we can get away with. But the most serious cases are not the situations where the quarantine authority is of most use. The quarantine authority is of most use in cases which are not emergencies, but in which I do need to get a person to do something that he has to this point been unwilling to do. These are also situations where, in my judgment, if we involve the court, we may, in fact, get a perverse outcome, and I'd like to talk a bit about that.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Ford and then Representative Bigrock.
Before you.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Dr. Ms. Gebbe said something that was, that this is all just kind of coming back to me, and it's gnawing at me. What happens, say, if there is more of a panic because of the nature of the virus, and there's someone else there, the head of the health division, besides Ms. Gebbe, and confidentiality is there, but it goes by the wayside because all of a sudden somebody is going to decide through administrative rule that they're going to an aisle or quarantine everybody with AIDS. Without something of this nature in the statute, could that not happen?
Well, I would suspect that somebody could attempt to write such a rule. In fact, there's a history of somebody attempting to write such a rule. It took place in the state of Texas about a year ago. That rule survived approximately 3 days and was never implemented. So although it is possible to do that, I don't think of it as much of a practical problem.
However,
people can panic, but I want to point out where panic is more likely to occur. In the state of Oregon, to my knowledge, there has been no violation of confidentiality by public health officials, and there has been no inappropriate use of public health authority with respect to AIDS by public health officials. However, if you go to the court system and the prison system, there you will find examples which abound. You will find judges who order HIV tests from the bench without any clear knowledge of why it should be ordered and why it should not be ordered. I have had to talk with defense attorneys about issues related to HIV because of inappropriate breaches of confidentiality in the judicial system. I mean, these things do happen because people who aren't medically trained and aren't informed about the health issues may overreact when they get certain forms of information or suspect certain forms of information. So while I have every confidence in the judicial system in protecting our individual civil rights, for most cases, I think we ought to keep the technical question, you know, who's infected, who's not, what are the consequences of infection, in the hands of people with more technical training. When something goes awry there, the law says that ultimately these things are thrashed out in court.
I understand that, and that does reassure me a little, but I'm also concerned that perhaps even if a rule only lasted a few days, it still could breach. Anybody shown or quarantined would automatically have confidentiality breach. Mm-hmm. Now, how do we solve that?
Well, let me give you my easy answer to that. My easy answer to that is be darn sure that somebody competent is appointed director or administrator of the health division. I say that because there is no protection in the system of law against public official malfeasance. And if you think there is, then you need to look at the Reagan White House.
No partisan statements, please.
The same thing has happened under other administrations, but we have a particularly good example right now. What the issue is that you need to have a system of good law, and you also need to have good people. The way the confidentiality law works right now, as a public official, I can go out and violate the confidentiality of any person with a communicable disease report on our books without any protection for that person, because there isn't a protection in statute. What you've got in the first five sections of this bill is a very specific statutory standard, which in fact is the one I use anyway when I think about violating somebody's confidentiality. For example, somebody with tuberculosis. I may need to tell the landlady that that person has TB if I'm going to have an effective restriction on that person to stay in the apartment. There have been occasions when I have thought about what the risk and benefit is to the public, and I have deliberately violated the confidentiality of somebody with a communicable disease. But I never do it lightly, and I do it according to the standard that's proposed in this bill. We do need a standard, but nothing whatever protects us against deliberate malfeasance. I wish something would, but this just you just can't do it.
One more question, Mr. Chair.
No, Representative Abrams.
Well, I imagine I'm probably asking your question, Representative Ford.
If he's not, we'll come back to it.
The examples that you cite, specifically in talking about quarantine and a better process than the one that is spelled out here, all talk to alcoholism and tuberculosis and so forth. Both of which have known cures, you know, at least there's treatment for mm-hmm. them, and you're only quarantining people who are just refusing to do that, and most of course do. Can we really draw the same parallel, use that as a basis for making judgments about AIDS, which are not, you know, not alcohol, not airborne bacteria, but really are among people who are getting them through sexual means or through contaminated hypodermics and a whole different kind of folk that may, in fact, a higher percentage of them require some severe disciplines in order to affect a control than you would with the other. And that's...
Well, that's a complicated question. Let me take a stab at the first part of it. First of all, the reason for quarantining somebody who has tuberculosis and refuses treatment is not to institute treatment. You have a right to refuse treatment. The one thing which I don't tell TB patients is you have to take these pills. I do say you have to take these pills if you want to get better, but if you choose not to take the pills for some reason, that's your business. It's my business as a local health officer if you refuse to take the pills and you then frequent a place where you can expose some other person. I won't make any attempt to make somebody take the pills. There's nothing in the law that says I can do that. But I will make every attempt to get that person to stay home or stay in the hospital or stay someplace where there isn't the risk of exposing other people. Now, the difficulty is carrying that example over to AIDS-HIV infection, and that really stalled the HIV Policy Committee for quite some time, because there's no easy way to carry it over. First of all, if you walk into a room with somebody who has TB and that person coughs and you're unlucky, you could get infected. I mean, most of the time it takes about 800 hours in the same room, but one cough at the wrong time and you could be infected with TB. You have no notice that that person is infected necessarily, and you have no easy personal protective action which you can take aside from not being in the room with them. You can't, for example, refuse to share a needle with them or refuse to have sex with them, as is the easy way to protect against getting AIDS from somebody you don't know is infected. So it's a real different kind of area, primarily because of the differences in how the illness is transmitted. Now, some would argue that we need to impose some sort of restrictions on people we know are infected with HIV, infected with the agent which causes AIDS. There is a problem with doing that. And the problem with doing that is it's only the tip of the iceberg. Most of the people who are infected we don't know about and will never know about. Second of all, most of the experts I've talked to believe that attempting to do that will, number one, not change behavior in the person we do it on unless we lock the individual up, probably not a legally permissible action, and second, will send a very dangerous message to everybody else out there who might be infected and will have a negative overall effect on control of the disease. Because what we want is people who participate in behaviors that put them at risk. One, to change their behavior. Two, to consider voluntary testing and counseling, especially if there's any possibility that that will cause them to change their behavior. To do that, you need a cooperative system, and you need people's confidence. For years and years, we resisted the notion of imposing quarantine on tuberculosis patients out of fear that would drive the rest of the TB patients out of our clinic. Even now, we use that only as a last measure and only with very careful preconditioning so that everybody knows that we're not doing it because the person has TB, but because the person is, in fact, putting other individuals at risk. Difficult area. I wish I could give you a simple answer, and I wish I could tell you that I know exactly how to decide that issue. I don't.
Any other questions? If not...
Thank you very much.
Thank you. We've been at it for a while here. We've got one last witness, but what I'd like to do is take a 10-minute break, be back here at 3:30, so that I can have a toxic substance break. We will come back to order. I'd like to invite Ted Falk. Is it Falk or Falk? Ted? Hi, Ted.
Hi. My name is Ted Falk.
Falk.
F-A-L-K. Sorry, got my handwriting. I'm an attorney, and I'm with the Portland firm of Spears, Labrowski, Campbell, Bledsoe, Anderson & Young, and I was one of the draftsmen, I suppose you might say, of this bill. I mean, Len Perlman really set pen to paper, but I was one of the people on the HIV/AIDS Policy Committee that worked on developing the concept of this legislation. I have some written testimony which is being distributed to you, and I won't. It's not necessary for me to walk through that today, partly because Chris Gebbe has covered the points in some detail in terms of describing what the bill does. But let me just cover the high points that I mentioned in my testimony. I wanted to set this against a little bit of a historical background about public health statutes and the use of coercive control measures in the control of diseases. For a very long time, venereal diseases have been treated as a separate category. And that's partly due to the fact that there are very powerful social feelings about sexuality, which have made venereal diseases as something set apart from other things. And even the word venereal, I think, indicates that. Venereal just means Venus, like the god of love. But as we all know, it's love and sex are not necessarily the same thing. And as a result of the distinctive feelings about venereal disease, it has always been treated as a distinctive category. There are a lot of old cases which have approved the use of quarantine and all sorts of other coercive devices in control of both venereal diseases and other sorts of communicable diseases. I don't have the slightest doubt that those cases are now bad law, and I cited in my memorandum a number of legal commentaries which support the view that those things are bad law. If someone, Oregon's statutes for control of venereal diseases and communicable diseases are very similar to the statutes of most states, but if you try to apply those quarantine provisions as they stand without supplying any sort of due process protections, you would undoubtedly have an unconstitutional situation. So I think that the repeal of the venereal disease statute is something very much to be welcomed. It has nothing to do with the actual control measures that are used with regard to venereal diseases. The Health Division has venereal disease control programs. Those would continue. The existence of the statute had nothing to do with the authority for those venereal disease control programs. Indeed, if you look at the definition in ORS Chapter 434 of venereal disease, you'll find that it names five venereal diseases and then any other disease which the Health Division names by rule. I think that within that definition, it's quite questionable as to whether AIDS is a venereal disease, even though it is sexually transmitted, and even though in the popular currency it would be considered a venereal disease, but in the technical sense, it quite possibly doesn't come in within the venereal disease statute. So whatever usefulness the venereal disease statute might have with regard to AIDS is I think, somewhat of a moot point. The Health Division has, by rule, designated AIDS to be a reportable disease, but that was done under authority of the communicable disease statute, and I don't think that there is any good argument that you can expand that statutory definition of venereal disease to include AIDS. Now, I'd like to say some words about the quarantine procedure because that's something that has given rise to some discussion. The existing procedures in the bill, the procedures in the bill, not the existing procedures, are based on the procedures for involuntary civil commitment on the basis of mental illness. Indeed, they're practically word for word the same, except changing where you need to change the words, changing mental illness to communicable disease and other sorts of verbal changes, but it was really lifted just about wholesale. And that has one advantage, and that is that people who are familiar with the procedure for going through an involuntary commitment hearing will already be up to speed to some extent on how to do a quarantine procedure. I mean, they'll have to read the statute, but they will understand a lot of the basic concepts that are being used. It does, however, have a disadvantage, and that is that the civil commitment statute is under review right now, and although I have not checked to see what the status of the bills, there are two bills in the legislature for reform of the civil commitment procedures, and that will have the somewhat unfortunate result that you'll have slightly different procedures. You'll have the old civil commitment procedure in this bill, and if one of those other bills passes, you'll have a new civil commitment procedure in the other in the civil commitment statutes itself. The changes, however, are of a relatively minor sort, and I don't think that they would change the basic character of the civil commitment process, and I also think that those changes could be made in this statute later on. Now, the quarantine procedure is really divided into two parts, and again, this follows the civil commitment procedure. There is an emergency provision, which can last up to 72 hours with a possible extension, and then there is the full-dress court procedure. And a lot of the situations that Dr. Shade was mentioning in terms of needing to go into a restaurant and corner somebody, I think could be handled under the emergency provisions. the emergency provisions are really quite summary, just as the as all of the provisions are right now. The main difference is that even when you end in an emergency, you would have to provide some sort of notice to a court, and then you would then have to follow through and initiate a court proceeding if the quarantine were going to last beyond a certain point. I should also point out that in a lot of situations, in addition to the general quarantine power, there are specific licensure statutes, and that would apply, for example, to restaurants. And so it isn't necessary to use the general quarantine statute in every situation in which you have a dangerous individual in restaurants and healthcare facilities and in a lot of other specific licensed activities. The health division or some other regulatory agency already has separate authority to go in and take care of a dangerous situation. I think there is no getting around the fact, though, that the quarantine provisions of this bill are a compromise. They're a compromise between civil liberties and public health. I think that that compromise was necessary because the quarantine issue has become a highly charged and emotional issue for a lot of people. I think that if there had been no changes in the quarantine statute, I think a lot of people would have been just terrified of the possibility that quarantine authority would be abused. Now, there isn't the slightest history in Oregon of any abuse whatsoever of quarantine authority, but there have been proposals made elsewhere in the country for what I would describe as an abuse of quarantine authority, particularly with regard to AIDS. And so I think it was necessary to make it clear through stricter statutory provisions that that quarantine is an extraordinary procedure and will only be used in very highly defined circumstances. And as far as the cost of that procedure, I think that once the provisions of the new quarantine procedure became known, it would be similar to the cost of a civil commitment proceeding, and those are handled on a fairly machine-like basis by a lot of counties, and I think that this could be handled in by the same people and using much the same procedure. Finally, I'd like to respond to Representative Gold's question, even though she isn't sitting in her chair, about informed consent and confidentiality. I do have a draft of of some language on informed consent and confidentiality. It's somewhat unfortunate that a bill implementing those procedures was not introduced into the legislature at an early enough stage. But I think that everyone on the HIV Policy Committee and everyone in the Health Division and is supportive of some legislation in this regard. And there are two ways it could be introduced at this late date. One would be by special consent, I guess, of the Speaker of the House, and another would be, since it could appropriately take the form of amendments to ORS Chapter 43, would be to introduce those provisions as amendments to the present bill. The concept of the informed consent and confidentiality proposals are spelled out in the book, the Redbound AIDS Epidemic book, which I assume has been distributed to members of the committee. Is that correct?
Well, every member of the legislature, I believe, has received a copy of it.
Okay. And on page 62 and page 66 are described the specific proposals with regard to statutes that are needed with regard to informed consent to blood testing and with regard to confidentiality. And those would, I think, appropriately take the form of amendments to ORS Chapter 433, and therefore I think they could be introduced as an amendment to this bill. And so if that's something that the committee would be receptive to, then...
You say you had a memorandum to that?
Yeah, well, I have a draft of a bill. It's handwritten, and I'll get it typed by tomorrow, okay. And I can send it down to you, and then
please.
You can look at it and consider whether you think that would appropriately be take the form of an amendment. It certainly would be a lot easier to do it that way than to try to go through this whatever special consents are needed at this stage of the game. The
speaker's getting rather reluctant to approve any more bills.
I'm sure that's true, and I don't think that it really expands the basic scope of the bill, because it is something in which the Health Division would be taking an administrative role. So I will be happy to send those down. This particular draft of the informed consent and confidentiality provisions has not passed through as many people's eyes as the communicable disease thing goes, and so I think it would take a little bit of refining, but I think it would give you the idea of what could be done in that area.
Okay, looking over your memorandum,
yeah.
I wish I had read this before I had asked my questions. Basically, as I'm reading your memorandum here, some of my attitudes date back to the last century.
In the early part of the century, people venerated public health officials and really and gave them quite sweeping legal powers in accordance with that.
On page 3, during World War I, you're indicating they locked up 15,000 American prostitutes. And it, according to this, it had no effect then on the spread of venereal disease?
Well, the problem with venereal disease in World War I as it is today is that lots of people spread it other than prostitutes. And even in World War I, the tremendous bulk of the disease was spread through nice people. So locking up all those prostitutes just didn't have any effect. It certainly kept those prostitutes from spreading the disease, but it didn't arrest the spread of venereal disease.
I thought that the sexual revolution didn't occur until the 60s, but I guess that's not the case. That nice folks were spreading the disease back then.
That's correct.
Penicillin either.
Excuse me?
Penicillin either.
They did not have penicillin in 1918, although there was a some sort of treatment at that time, some sort of heavy metal thing, which I'm not familiar with. But it wasn't entirely effective.
Heavy metal?
Representative Van Loon.
Mercury or lead or something like that.
Okay. On page 6 of the material that you gave us, halfway down the page, a little bit more than, you refer to ORS Chapter 443 as the communicable disease statute.
That's a misprint. I apologize.
Okay,
that should be that should be 433.
Two places then in there.
Okay.
It should be. The numbers are transposed.
Yes, I apologize. I did draft this testimony in a great hurry, and I apologize. That should be 433.
At 433?
It should be 433 on both those lower places on page 6.
Ted, you know, you heard my earlier question about, you know, the lengthy due process that's outlined under Section 10. You know, how long would it take? I mean, let's say we have somebody with tuberculosis, as you know, Charles indicated, and you know they're in an infectious state, and we can't contain them. How long would it take me to go through all of the hurdles established in Section 10 so I can get these people or this person out of the public context?
Well, as I said, civil commitment is the model here, and it begins by an emergency provision, which can take up to 72 hours, and then it can be extended, I believe, for another 72 hours. And then at that point, you need to have a court hearing. It's my understanding that court hearings for civil commitment can be scheduled on quite short notice.
And it would be the intent that the same thing would occur here.
That's correct. There is one change in comparison with civil commitment procedure, and that is a civil commitment order is good for 180 days. It has to be renewed by a new court proceeding every 180 days. We felt that because of the much more rapidly changing nature of most communicable diseases, that a 60-day order was more appropriate, because there just don't seem to be the same sort of arguments for very long-term commitment for any communicable disease as there might be in the case of a mental disease. But I think the civil commitment procedure, despite its complexity, is geared towards a rather rapidly changing situation. As a person's mental state can be changing quite rapidly, and it can be important to get them into a state hospital rather rapidly. And so even though the procedures are admittedly very cumbersome, they also take place rather rapidly.
Okay, but my question, you know, let me ask it another way then. From what you're saying, that this person who has tuberculosis, we want to get them out of the public context, it would take no longer than 6 days? Is that the assurance that you're giving me?
I'm afraid I don't have all the deadlines in mind. I mean, it's after 72 hours, it has to be court process initiated. Yeah, well, I'd actually rather have Len Perlman, the Health Division's attorney, respond to those things, because he's probably got the procedure more firmly fixed in my mind, and I'd be afraid of making a mistake if I answered your question.
Mm-hmm. Is Mr. Perlman out there? There you
go. Well, members of the committee, the bill provides for a 3-day scheduling of a hearing with an opportunity for an extension of 3 more days, but the hearing must be commenced within 3 days of the filing of the petition. Under the emergency procedure under section, I believe it's 11 of the bill, the person can be taken into custody immediately. The health official is required to appear immediately before a court and have a summary order taken in order to hold the individual, and then the procedure for the 3-day